Following is an interview with David N. Parker, P-A-R-K-E-R, Special Assistant to the President for Appointments and Scheduling. The interview was conducted by Susan Yowell on September 13, 1974, in Mr. Parker's office on the first floor of the old Executive Office Building. Get going. But as I said, our approach is very basic. And did I also mention that we're hoping that some of the information from these will be valuable to a more in-depth oral history project on the administration years, which may be done
years from now,
but we hope it will be done. I think that all of the libraries, since the Truman Library, have done oral history projects and have continuing ones right now. So we'll also ask you for a permanent address where we can reach you 10 years from now or whatever. And we're hoping to get these transcribed. We have a considerable backlog, which are not transcribed because we just haven't had the staff to do it. And we decided that the best thing to do is to get it on tape now, and that as quickly as we can, we will transcribe it.
Get as much down as possible.
Right.
Okay, well, I think probably the best thing that I should do is just simply kind of start off giving you a thumbnail sketch of my involvement with the appointments office organization since I came here, which was in January of 71. I joined Dwight Chapin's staff, handling and responsible for invitations and scheduled proposals. I replaced a fellow by the name of Hugh Sloan, who at that point was destined to move over to the Committee for the Re-election of the President. My functions during the first 2 years of the position, or 22 months of the position, centered primarily on developing schedule ideas for the President's schedule with an eye towards the 72 election. That's not to say that it was a political overtures, but doing those things that an incumbent president had to do to, in fact, make his re-election successful. I was very fortunate in having a very, very efficient professional staff that consisted of Helen Collie Donaldson, Mary Rollins, Barbara Franklin, and then 2 months after I joined the staff, I hired Nancy Gimmel to replace Barbara Franklin, who left, but then subsequently has joined us on two different occasions since then to work on special projects for us, mostly related to the First Family.
How were you recruited to join the staff?
Well, it's a real quirk.
Or do you know?
Well, I can say this. I was a special assistant to Wally Hickel. I was Wally Hickel's administrative assistant when he was Secretary of the Interior. And then when he was fired by President Nixon, I believe it was the 25th of November of 1970, I was then in a position of being virtually unemployed. At the same time, there was a famous political event that took place in town 2 days later where Fred Malek went to the Interior Department and fired six of Hickel's aides, me not being one of them. The reason I was not included in that, I believe, in looking at it in retrospect, was the fact that I had been in the Interior Department for 7 years prior to joining Hickel's staff, serving in various other capacities. So I was given the opportunity to transition Morton into his job, and Morton didn't get sworn in as Secretary of the Interior until something like January 23rd of 1971. So there was a 2 month interim period where there was some necessity for some continuity on front office operations, and I assisted Fred Russell, who was the acting secretary and undersecretary at that time. And then we transitioned in Morton, and I felt that it would be in Morton's best interest and in my own best interest to leave. That is, to leave the Morton operation, even though he asked me to stay, based primarily on a prior friendship I had with him when I worked congressional relations for the Interior Department, and he was on the House Interior Committee. But I had made a big attempt to go to work out in Denver, Colorado for the, as the environmental planner for the Western Water Plant. This was a legislatively directed plan where the study of transfer of water from one point, one resource in the West to another would take place. And I applied for that position and received it. And as a matter of fact, the day I was called to take the job in Denver was the same day I happened to be up at the dedication of the Eisenhower Center, where President Nixon was. And Dwight Chapin approached me and asked me if I could come and see him at the White House right after the event. I had been in it, had done some in-town and one out-of-town advance work in the prior year for President Nixon. Ron Walker was the one who got me involved in that. And I really, at that moment, when Chapin asked me to come see him, I didn't know whether this was a continuation of the purge of Hickel employees or what was going on. And I was asked to join the staff. And I told Chapin at the time that I thought that there might be some great philosophical difficulties because of my closeness to Hickel, because I perceived at the time that Hickel still was persona non grata in the administration. And Chapin didn't seem to think that that was much of an obstacle. But I insisted before we pursued the subject any further to talk to Haldeman about it. And when Haldeman and I talked about it, I told him that I was very flattered. And being a Boy Scout, I'd just come to work at the White House at the drop of the hat. But they had to know what my attachment emotionally and, you know, philosophically was to Wally Hickel. And if that was any problem, they didn't need me at the White House. Well, this was, at that point, Haldeman's response was that was absolutely no problem whatsoever. Because of my apparent integrity in that regard, I think that it even strengthened my position to come to the White House. And in turn, my esteem for particularly Haldeman increased considerably as a result of that. And that night, after I was offered the position, I had dinner with Hickel, who happened to be coming back into town for the first time since he left. And I recall going over to his suite in the Watergate Hotel, and both he and his wife were there, and I knocked on the door and came in. And I said, guess what? You won't believe what happened to me today. And I went through the whole litany of what had taken place in the course of the day about getting off of this job. And both Hickel and his wife, Emily, responded in unison when I told them that I'd been offered this job, that that was the greatest thing they had ever heard of. So it was a great, all of a sudden, it was emotionally for me. I still hadn't I had told Haldeman, fine, I was going to come on board. At the same time, I had to think about it. You know, I felt I had a 72-hour grace period to think about. Well, Hickel was just as excited about it as I was. And it was at that point that I really recognized that politics weren't as permanent as I had thought they were in terms of this Hickel's subsequent firing, which we all had known that was going to come to a head anyways. But you know, the hard feelings didn't really exist there as much as one would have thought that they would have in terms of carryover and how they would have fell off to other people. So it was an interesting thing, and there I was. I joined the White House staff and worked in primarily an administrative capacity in terms of handling all these invitations and schedule proposals and doing a lot of bulk staff work for Chapin, who really didn't like schedule work at all. He was he had the official title of Special Assistant to the President, but yet he was in fact the Appointment Secretary, and he was responsible for both the planning and the implementation of the President's schedule. He also had some corollary duties related to television activities and served as primarily as Haldeman's principal substantive assistant, whereas Butterfield was an administrative assistant, and then Higbee, of course, was the he was the extension of Haldeman in terms of administratively in Haldeman's office, giving directions and responding for Haldeman and behalf of Haldeman, things like that. Whereas my function was much more of an autonomous function, which I enjoyed a great deal because I was able to, in fact, be the scheduler. And Dwight just didn't want to have any part of it. The only time he ever wanted to see what was going in to be presented to the President was just before it went to Haldeman, and he would review it and say, great, in it would go, because he just didn't like to get tied up in the detail and have to do all the coordination with everybody, which was just a very heavy staff function.
This was something that he had been doing. You weren't replacing anyone else, really, were you?
Well, Sloan had done this to a limited extent, as I understood it. Although I did not work with Sloan, from what I heard from a lot of people, Hugh didn't have the same... He was a very tenacious type individual in terms of putting together a lot of paperwork. At the same time, I was more forceful in getting directly to people and not demanding, but making them get involved in the president's activities rather than just doing a lot of sheer conjecture that the president should be doing this or shouldn't be doing that, and then have the president say you do it and then backtracking and finding that, you know, Kissinger didn't want the president to do that. My feeling was that before anything went forward to the president, I had to have that all tied down. And so I'd go directly to Kissinger, say, you know, before we recommend to the president that you do this. And I instituted a lot of really small administrative measures that, for a schedule proposal format, for example. These are things that before you leave, we probably should give you copies of these so you can put them in the appointments office file. We developed a schedule proposal format, which we sent out the form to everybody in the White House and all the cabinet, and actively solicited their ideas for presidential involvement. And these proposals included on one page paper the type of meeting, the date, the purpose, the format, which included who would be participating, where the location would be, and what the president's remark requirement would be, and the length of remarks, what the speech material would be, what press coverage would be, the staff, who recommended it, who was opposed to it, what the president's previous participation with this organization, group, or meeting had been, and any other background, and then with an approval, disapproval block, and then that would go forward to the president. We put that together, and then in mid-year 71, this office, by the president's direction, it wasn't my first meeting with the president, but I had had an introductory meeting with the president, I think, in February of 71, where I was just introduced to him and, you know, a welcome aboard sort of thing. But sometime in mid-year, I'm not exactly sure when it was, I was called into the president's office with Haldeman, and the president asked that I take over the scheduling and recommendations for the first family scheduling. Well, this was a very precarious thing that I really didn't want to get involved in. I was flattered by the opportunity. At the same time, it was a situation where I knew of the administrative disorganization that existed in the first lady's staff, and I didn't really want to direct anybody or tell anybody what should or should not be done. So we developed a kind of separate arm, and everybody got behind it here. We started thinking about the first family a lot more. We put little things on our desk that said, "Think Mrs. Nixon, Julie, and Tricia," just so when we automatically changed something for the president where he wouldn't participate, we would see if it had any value for the first family. Then we started blocking up proposals, package proposals, a whole month of activities that they could consider. And we would send them over to the family, and they would review them, and then usually I'd go over and talk to them about it, and they would tell us what they would do or what they wouldn't do, and then I would sit down with Connie Stewart and go through what I had proposed. And Connie and Helen Smith and the East Wing staff would implement it. Now, we did that all through 71. Late in 71, Dwight got further and further away from the whole appointments process when he started getting involved in the China trip. And, well, really, that was really mid-71, July, I believe. And I got more and more directly involved with Haldeman, to where this was something that Bob had wanted to attain, was a direct relationship with the principal scheduler. And then in 72, Dwight again was involved in the Soviet trip, the China trip, which took place in February, and then the Soviet trip plan, which took place in June, which probably were the two most important things for the president's re-election, with the exception of McGovern's nomination by the Democrats themselves. And then, after the 72 election, my activities just magnified in terms of volume of the president's activities and the first family's activities, and then I got directly involved with the vice president's scheduled activities through the campaign. In the summer of 72, this officer is responsible for preparing integrated schedule proposals and plans for the president's schedule, the vice president's schedule, all the members of the first family, including Eddie Cox. David really was in the Navy, so we couldn't do anything with him. And then we even, on a kind of an informal basis, Ed Nixon used to call and we would advise him on where he was going and what he might do on behalf of the president, in the president's stead. And what we did, we prepared master schedules for all of them and integrated all of them to make sure that geographically they wouldn't be in the same places and that we would go to every state. So the Nixon flag would be shown all over the country. We were very sensitive to not use any public funds for expenditure of these activities and had the RNC pay for these activities. I really wasn't involved in that at all. I had the great fortune of proposing all this stuff, getting it approved, and then not really having to implement it, just knowing that it was implemented. During the spring of 72, Alan Hall, who had been on Ron Walker's staff, joined me to do all the advance work for the family. And it wasn't until July of 72 that Bill Kotus was detailed from the State Department, or took a leave of absence from the State Department, and then became involved in the implementation of the first family activities, since our advance office, run by Ron Walker, would not get involved in the first family activities because a lot of personality conflicts had existed between the first family and the Walker advance operation. So Bill Kotus coming over to implement the family activities after this office through Alan Hall, and with me having to spend a great deal of time being concerned about implementation for 3 or 4 months, which I had never had to have the responsibility for and didn't have the time for, was about the greatest relief that ever existed for me to have him come on board. So Bill and I worked hand in glove all through the campaign. We continued to do all the scheduling here for everybody, is what it really amounted to, and worked very closely with John Damgaard on the vice president's staff in preparing all of his activities. Then, in November of 72, we all prepared our wish list. And this was to where do you want to go when you become old enough to work in the government. Well, having been around the government at that point myself for 13 years, I had some pretty strong feelings. And number one, I wanted to go over and work in the Commerce Department tourism operation. And number two, the Park Service operation. I know I recall submitting my resignation and then my wish list, and I was called sometime late November by Haldeman, and he told me at that time that Dwight was going to be leaving and that the president wanted me to stay and be the appointment secretary. I was pleased in that I was delighted to finally be getting a commission after being here for 2 years, and not that the commission meant anything besides a piece of paper, but it was at least something to work for, and I succeeded in getting. At the same time, I really did want to go back to the government, but nevertheless did make the commitment that I would stay as the appointment secretary through August of 1973. And so then I took on a lot of other duties in connection with that. We restructured the Chapin function considerably, repeating what Dwight was responsible for all the planning and implementation of the president's activities, where I handled the planning. Steve Bull, Ron Walker handled aspects of the implementation, and Mark Good, who worked for Dwight, also handled television production. My role in the new setup was for me to be responsible for the schedule, all the schedule planning, an overview of implementation, but just coordination with Steve Bull and Bill Hinkle, who were really directly responsible for the implementation of the president's schedule after I had told them what the president had approved and how he wanted a particular event to go. And because Steve and Bill and I worked very closely together and had worked closely together for a number of years, we had no personality hang-ups and worked very well together through the very difficult Watergate period. But then I also assumed all the functions that Alex Butterfield had related to the cabinet liaison or cabinet secretary, in addition to taking over the functions that had been handled through Pat O'Donnell in the Colson office of the administration speakers bureau. So my role then was one of kind of being a large administrator of schedule activities for the president, for the cabinet, and for the administration as such. My activities also included clearing international travel for all political people, coordinating that with the State Department and NSC. They would have to get authorization from this office to travel overseas. That way we ensured maximum coordination with State NSC, and we held down the number of international boondoggles that people could create for themselves. Nancy Gimmel was the primary contact on that, handling all the paperwork and the whole administrative operation there. Then I hired John Guthrie to put together the Presidential Spokesman's Office. We changed the name from the Administration Speaker's Bureau, which implied more of a communications function, to do the President's Spokesman's Office, to which gave us more clout in terms of having direct access to the President and getting more representatives from the cabinet, the sub-cabinet, out around the country at appropriate forums that we deemed appropriate. And this was primarily a coordinative function. We didn't have any clout as such. Everybody knew we existed, but it was a matter of how persuasive we could be to the cabinet and the sub-cabinet to get them going. And I think there's an interesting story to be told how the whole spokesman's office got off the ground and developed, and you probably should talk separately to John Guthrie about that, because John was the one who was principally responsible for it. I tried to, I monitored the activities, and I had the overall responsibility for them, but I left John to be almost totally autonomous and spending as little bit of time, or as much time as needed, giving him direction at the same time, not involved in the management of his activities at all, if I could help it. Then part of the commitment that I made to Haldeman about leaving in August was to find somebody to replace me by August. And I went through an extensive interview process, must have interviewed 20 or 30 people during this period, and was not really fully successful in thinking that I was going to be able to train these people and put them in this seat before I was to leave. And, you know, let me step back for just a second. When Chapin left, Haldeman gave me the option of being the appointment secretary, and I suggested that I not be the appointment secretary, rather I just take a nebulous title of special assistant to the president. And he, a lot of different people that I was dealing with pulled at me. Some said you should be the appointment secretary, that's a good functional title that will do you well in the future, etc. And I think my comment to Haldeman was I'd rather be buried in the anonymity of being the special assistant. Simply, and really I felt functionally too, since my activities had changed. I wasn't really responsible for the implementation of the president's activities per se. I was only responsible for the planning of them, then the cabinet liaison, or the cabinet secretary role. So it was really funny because I went through this, and this went on for 2 or 3 weeks, various people pulling at me, and finally I made the decision that it was definitely going to be the special assistant, which I was really pleased with, because as the events developed over the next 2.5 years, anybody who had any title in the Nixon inner circle, which could be loosely construed that an appointment secretary was part of the inner circle, yet a special assistant didn't really have to be. So from a political and personal standpoint, it was just an interesting development. But then, when Bob Haldeman left on the 30th of April in 73, a couple days later I was asked if I'd be interested in having Terry O'Donnell join me, who had just joined Haldeman's staff as kind of a personal aide just in the prior 30 days or whatever. And having worked with Terry in First Family activities and advance work in the previous about a year and a half, I was just delighted to have him join me, because he's one of the most intelligent, buttoned-down, tenacious people I had ever met. So Terry then joined my staff as the principal scheduler. He did all the basic schedule work that I had done for Chapin and until he joined the staff. And then I moved much more into the cabinet liaison activities of just handling a lot of little hot potatoes, and then we moved into the entire Watergate era. And my role, functionally I handled the things that were assigned to me, but then I spent a great deal of time just kind of floating around, assisting other professionals and the White House staff and the domestic consul staff in building ideas in creating programs and getting these things implemented government-wide in a very, very low-key fashion, as we all did. And it was really a kind of cementing the bonds of a fraternity of people who were under siege, which is what the environment developed as we went through this whole process. Then that really lasted. August 73 came and went, and I was still here. Didn't really feel I could leave because I felt some sort of, I had some sort of obligation to President Nixon, and didn't think that it would be useful to leave during the Watergate trauma, really. So I continued to stay through the year, and Al Haig, of course, came on board, and my role with Al, I functioned and worked directly with Haldeman before Haig, and then with Haig, working all my activities directly to the Chief of Staff, who in turn would take them up with the President. During those years that I was here, I probably only met with the President personally maybe 3-4 times a year, and usually that was in the presence of the Chief of Staff. And then my Cabinet Secretary role expanded considerably when Haig came on board, and I was then responsible for all the Cabinet meetings, the briefing papers, and things of the Cabinet meetings, and had much more dealing with the President in terms of participating in meetings that he was present in by participating in all the Cabinet meetings, even though there wasn't a lot of face-to-face activities with him. And then had the responsibility of following up and taking notes and things like that as the Cabinet Secretary. This role continued with Haig until President Nixon left, with varying degrees of involvement with the President. He took a very active interest in his schedule in late 1973, and again in about February and March of 74. His concern with his schedule completely dissipated in late April, early May of 1974, with the exception of focusing totally on the Middle Eastern and the Soviet trip, which we knew were going to happen. At the same time, we're under absolute instructions not to move off on it and communicate this with people. So we couldn't get our planning going. So what ended up befalling to this office was the responsibility of being the tour directors for the Middle East and the Soviet trip, while Bill Hinkle, whose normal function would be the tour director, physically, as soon as we got the go-ahead about the 1st of June, went over to the Middle East and pre-advanced everything and then fed everything back into this operation, where Terry O'Donnell and I put all the pieces together and handled the setups of the trip, briefing the staff as to who would be going on the trip and the protocols and preparing the schedules and just handling all the niceties with the President's activities and the First Family's activities. That really then really served kind of as a capstone in my career. I did go to the Middle East on that trip. We were only halfway finished with the trip when we got to Cairo in terms of putting all the pieces together. And after working the entire month of June, probably averaging 18 hours a day in the office, and then going to Cairo and doing the same thing in Cairo, and then moving on to Jeddah and Damascus and Jerusalem, we concluded the trip. I know I jumped out of Jerusalem with Kissinger and went to the Azores and met with the Portuguese and set up that activity, that the President's one-on-one meeting with President Spinola in the Azores. And then when the President left the Azores, came back, and then we started putting together the Soviet trip. And mind you, this was only a week before the Soviet trip. Well, we put that together, and that trip was effectively complete when the President left for Brussels prior to going into the Soviet Union. And I took a vacation at that time, and that activity, the international involvement, the tour directing activities, served as the capstone. I made the decision that I, in fact, was going to pick up my commitment to leave the prior year, this year, and committed to my wife to leave by September 1st when we were on a vacation in Wyoming in early, well, while the President was in the Soviet Union, we went off to Wyoming. Came back here and started developing and setting up the organization to where I could leave, where Guthrie would take over the liaison activities and Terry O'Donnell would take over all the spokesman's activities, or the the appointments activities, and I got my resumes out and started talking to people about jobs, which I had never done prior to that, feeling that, you know, that just wasn't really fair. And then, of course, let's see, I went out, my concluding project for the president was to prepare a calendar that would take him through the end of the year. And Terry and I spent the first 3 weeks in July putting that together, and I took it out to California to present it to the president out there, and was flying over Oklahoma when the Supreme Court announced their 8-0 decision that the president would turn over his tapes. So when I got to San Clemente, it was kind of like I shouldn't have bothered to get go anyways. I spent a couple days out there and talked with a number of people out there about this, and, you know, not really being aware of what was going on directly, although knowing that, you know, some real problems were probably in the works. So I then turned around and came back here, and meanwhile started talking to people further about leaving. And it wasn't until the president departed, or came back and then said that he in fact had been involved in the Watergate, which at that point, or up until that point, myself and I'm sure many of us on the staff had given him every benefit of the doubt in any way, shape, or form, regardless of any feelings we had or suspicions we may have had in our own mind because of the great things that he had done for world peace. That, you know, the whole Watergate thing in perspective didn't seem to be as large as it in fact really was. But once he announced that he in fact had told a lie to the public and broken the public's trust, a strong sense of hurt, and even to a point of been described to me as a betrayal, set in with a number of people. And it was at that point that the president left, you know, on the Friday the night. And in my, just a sidelight, is a quirk of my own fate. President Nixon left at 10 o'clock on the 9th. I interviewed for the current position that I'm going to take at 10:45 on the 9th, which I had set up previously to it. I was back here for President Ford's oath swearing at 12 that day. And then after President Ford came in, it was a question of, you know, how are we going to transition him, not knowing whether we would have jobs or not. It took us about, I think, 8 hours. The following morning, Al Haig called and said, what's the president supposed to be doing? And Terry and I were off and running again. We were putting together the president's calendar. Well, this gave us the opportunity to take this whole four-month plan, or end-of-the-year plan that we had put together for President Nixon, and recast it for President Ford. Because there are a lot of things that the president has to do. It doesn't make any difference who's in that office, the president has to do it. So that became the overriding goal. We put together the president's weekly schedules, and then putting together this end of the year plan. And my whole thought in this was to put together this conceptual plan for him, so he knew that some people were here thinking about what he had to be involved in through the end of the year and even the month of January, which we discussed. That gave him a feel for what he has to do in the month of January, particularly related to the reconvening of Congress, State of the Union economic message, and budget message. So we focused on that. At the same time, I was then caught between should I leave or not. Well, I had made the commitment to leave. I'd been here for 3.5 years. I'd been in staff work with Hickel and here for 5.5 years. And I was frankly physically and emotionally exhausted and really wanted to get into something more substantive. Because I had been involved and interested in the tourism activity 2 years prior, when the opportunity came up to go over and join Lane Washburn as his deputy in this function, I decided that I would in fact pick up that option and go. And talked at length to Haig about my departure. And while I didn't talk at that point to President Ford about my departure, I had assurances from Haig that he had greased the skids, that there wasn't going to be any problem, and that I wasn't going to be asked to stay longer and thus miss the opportunity of taking this position, et cetera, et cetera. And I know we had an extensive meeting with the president, President Ford, on, I think it was the 23rd of August, where we talked about this whole four-month schedule. And before we went in to meet, I made Haig swear to me that he had in fact covered the whole spectrum of my desire to still depart or to move to another position in the administration so I wouldn't be prevailed upon to stay for any period of time. And he assured me that he did, although my resignation letter, while I had submitted it on the 20th, still hadn't come back out. So I was concerned that the president didn't know and would just assume that I was going to continue this function for him. And maybe he wanted me to, maybe he didn't. I mean, nothing was ever said about it, but I had made the decision in my own mind that I was making the right decision
patterning, I used the pattern of the prior experience I had had in transitioning more. Best that all of us old staff people, regardless of the fact whether we were close or were not close to Nixon, if we were perceived to be close to Nixon, let's just go away. We are physically tired. We are mentally, you know, strained on this whole thing, emotionally all wrought out. And then a year or two or three or whatever it is, if the president wants us to come back, or if we can continue to serve the president in other capacities such as I'm going into, fine. Then we're continuing to, you know, be part of the team at the same time, not subject his new staff to the charges of keeping the old Nixon staff. So I feel very, very pleased about my departure. And while I wasn't able to adhere to the September 1st retirement date, I was told that if I stayed to the 15th of September, everything would work out. So I've been transitioning into my new job for the last week and a half, including my trip to Mexico City the last 3 days, at the same time trying to wrap up all my activities here.
What is your official title going to be over there? It's at Commerce.
Right, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Tourism. So it's been an interesting experience and very rewarding. Kind of a sidelight to this whole operation in terms of how it's developed under the new administration. Terry O'Donnell has moved from this office over to become the primary schedule guy, personal aide to the president, President Ford, from this office.
And really taking Steve Bull's position.
He's taking over all of Steve Bull's activities, and then some. And then Warren Restan, who was a scheduling director for the vice president, was caught in a position of, while he intended to go back to Arizona, he knew that I was leaving, and while he wanted to be part of the team, he also has a very lucrative business going in Arizona, and wanted to go back to that at the same time, understanding my interest in departing, but not wanting, the last thing he wanted to do, he really wanted me to stay, so he wouldn't have any appearance of pushing me out, and I wanted him to come, so I could in fact leave. So it was really funny, so it worked out. So Warren is now, they announced his appointment on Tuesday of this week, and simultaneous to that, they announced my appointment over at Commerce. So today's my last day. Really wrapping it all up, putting it all together. So,
to go back over to some of the things you mentioned, how close of supervision, I don't know that that's the right word, but how closely did Dwight Chapin review the schedules that you said that he preferred just to receive them completed and sign off on them, but how closely did he work with you on developing the schedules?
Oh, Dwight and I had a way of communicating with each other without really having to sit down and talk about a lot of things. We thought a great deal alike in terms of our creative aspects of our mind. Thinking. I sit down every day with him and spend a half hour, 45 minutes, and we would philosophize about what the president should or should not be doing. And then I'd go do all the work for it, and then I'd come back in once every 4 or 5 days, and I'd have packages to go into the Haldeman and the president that would make a series of proposals and just verbally explain them to Dwight. He'd put his C on them, and then they would go.
And what kind of feedback did you get from Mr. Haldeman's office?
Well, usually as soon as he got the answers from the president, he'd call us over and we'd sit down and go through the whole thing. And got a great deal of philosophy back from Haldeman on what the president wanted to do. He used to send us a lot of memoranda in terms of what the president's desires were schedule-wise, much more so than Haig. Haig just didn't have a feel for the importance of the schedule, and he just left it all up to us, and we many times felt that we were really flying blind, but we would put in all the president's schedule activities would be proposed from this desk, but yet no communication with the president directly, and very little philosophy coming back from Haig, because he didn't really understand what we needed, whereas Haldeman had, because he had been involved in this for, you know, 13, 14 years, that sort of activity, as well as Chapin. Plus, it was a different ball game. I mean, everything up to 72 was focused towards the election. You know, there's a lot of things that were presidential but yet political in nature that one aimed at and did. So it was just a whole different cast of characters and parameters and things that, you know, we were dealing with.
I realized that when you did a schedule proposal, you routinely sent out feelers to people who might have an interest in that particular activity.
Right.
In addition to that, were there other major sources of input on a broader base of scheduling?
Well, any idea we could pick up.
In addition to the...
Sure, any, you know, I personally read the New York News, the New York Post, the Washington Post, the Journal, the Washington Star every day, the news summaries, watched the three network programs every day, picked up ideas from that, and constantly went around, and as I mentioned, particularly in the last year and a half of my job, talking to staff people, what we needed to do, what we should do, and developing ideas, getting them to develop schedule ideas, philosophies. We scheduled lots of meetings where we would have schedule planning meetings or creative sessions. We had one group that was headed by Dick Moore back in late 72 and early 73 that we called the December group. It was just a matter of what does the president need to do and what are some of the nice things, and things that he put his stamp on. We had the news planning groups, then there was the morning coordination meetings that John Bennett chaired for a while. All sorts of different sorts of meetings and structured sessions that involved many people in the White House. And my level of dealing with people was primarily at the operational level. That is, I dealt with the Jim Cavanaughs and the Jerry Jones and the Ken Clausens, rather than dealing with the Birches, the Armstrongs, the Kissingers. Well, I dealt with those people, but only after all the staff work was done. We had very little contact with the press office, not nearly as much as we should have. That is, with Ziegler himself. Ron's arrogance really prevailed, and he usually wasn't interested in anything until the last minute. And because of this, he had a great deal of faith in the schedule operation, and therefore didn't ever prevail much. And Ziegler really didn't have a role in scheduling. With the exception of the last 6 or 8 months of the president's schedule, when both he and Haig were kind of in tandem recommending things to the president. And then I would sit down with Ziegler about once a week and tell him everything that I was doing and the proposals I was going to make on the schedule so he could plant seeds with President Nixon if he thought they were good ideas. So we would ensure receptiveness.
What about coordination with the advance office prior to scheduling an event? Did you feel them out on the possibilities of what could be done and whether it could be done? And how?
Well, in many cases, you knew since the president was going to be involved in the activity, it had to be a pretty big activity in the first instance. So you knew it could be accomplished. What I would try to do would be to get long-range conceptual approval of activities and then turn around and ask Hinkle to go out and do a survey, where he'd come back with a survey report that would give us a specific recommendation. While we didn't have that institutionalized as such, that was always the standard operating procedure. Even if we gained the Ben approved, which might be a half-baked idea, or many times half-baked ideas would just get approved wherever they would come from, who only knew? We were just told the president will do X on X, and we would go forward with that. However that would develop, then if Hinkle would go out and survey it and conclude that just no way it could be done, then we would just go back and just say there's no way it could be done and retract the proposal. We had a great deal of latitude in the implementation of the president's activities. There was a team of people who primarily didn't have any desire to be exposed to the press as such. That is, if the press asked me questions, I always had to laugh. How the you say the president's insulated and he won't see these people and he won't do that. And the press always made these bold pronouncements about what the president was doing and what he wasn't doing and what he was thinking of and what he wasn't thinking of related to his schedule. But I can honestly say in the 3.5 years I was here, I don't think I ever had 5 press queries asking me directly what the president was thinking about schedule-wise. It was just an interesting phenomenon.
Did the press office field them for you?
I'm sure many times the press office did, but I mean it was a function of many times the Nixon staff was considered to be inaccessible. But the truth, while that might be partially true, The full truth is that in most cases, the press didn't even bother taking time to ask. There was a perception that they had, and it worked both ways. I mean, it was, I think that you could talk to people like, well, I didn't strike up strong relationships with anybody in the press, but Carol Kilpatrick is a good example. He asked me questions on half a dozen occasions, and I think press generally was confused, too, who was the appointment secretary, particularly in the latter days of the Nixon administration, because quite often they would appoint, they would see Steve Bull, and they would say that Steve was the appointment secretary. Well, after all the negative news that Dwight had had and Steve had had related to the 18-and-a-half-minute gap involvement, it was something that we never had any desire to try to clarify, neither Steve nor myself. So the decision that I made to be buried in the anonymity of a special assistant was probably the best decision I ever made in terms of my own personal well-being.
How closely did you coordinate with Steve Bull on scheduled proposals, or did it just go through Haldeman and then
Fed Bank? Oh, well, Steve and Bill Hinkle and I were on our phones, we were connected by private lines, and we were constantly talking to each other. I mean, we were, by the nature of Steve and Bill and I, in terms of how we got along with each other and how we carved out our respective areas of responsibility, we just relied a great deal on each other to advise, and had no concern about, I never bothered me at all to tell Hinkley he was doing something wrong or he was doing it right, and vice versa. And the same thing applied with Steve. I mean, we were close enough to where we could be very forthright and candid in the president's interest, and this worked very well. The nature of the personalities. Now, if the personalities were different, it may not work as well. Matter of fact, I've recommended that the new structure, that be straightened out a little bit, that there be a little more centralized control in one office of what's the total schedule picture is, more along the lines of the function that Chapin played in 69 and early 70, of being responsible for both planning and implementing. Mm-hmm. So that's where we are now.
In your role as cabinet secretary, I did talk with John Whitaker after he left, and I guess he started that, and then Mr. Butterfield picked it up.
Right.
We did not talk with Mr. Butterfield. Did you do the cabinet secretary's job essentially in the same manner that Mr. Butterfield had?
Yeah, I believe so. I was responsible for the assignment of presidential representations and sensitive matters that had to be communicated to the president or to the cabinet, and vice versa, that I would handle these. I think that best probably can be described by some paper that I can give you that you can crank in there, that things we put together for Haig, so you can talk to Jerry Ford or President Ford about what this office has been responsible for. And they're pretty concise in terms of telling what we did versus what we didn't. The big difference between John Whitaker as cabinet secretary and then Alex Butterfield assuming those functions and me in turn assuming those functions was that the domestic council didn't exist when John Whitaker was the cabinet secretary and before him Bob Ellsworth, where it had a real substantive role. Under Butterfield and myself, it had, the position didn't really have a substantive role. It was coordinative in nature. For example, in preparation of cabinet agendas and papers and things like that, it was one where I would spend a great deal of time with Ken Cole and Ron Ash and people like that, working out talking points and agenda items and things. They provided the substance and I simply put the pieces together, developed the format. And
did you do the summaries of cabinet meetings?
Yes.
And were all of the cabinet secretary files kept in a separate location from
yes.
your appointments files?
Yes. And they're all in separate boxes and they've been picked up and sent to the archives in that regard.
Okay.
And Nancy Gimmel served as the only person in my office handling those activities. So she's totally familiar with them, as well as Nancy handling all the international trip clearances. Helen Donaldson moved in strictly to handle schedule proposals and developing of ideas. Mary Rollins developed all the, she was the chief of the invitation section, is what I really amounted to, and has continued. How she likes that, I don't know. And then Mary Widener joined our staff a couple of years ago, and backstops everybody. has a great capacity to do a little bit of everything. And I've been blessed with what I think is the best staff in the White House. The staff has been together since the first. Been a couple little changes. Of course, Barbara Franklin was here. Barbara came back on two different occasions working with First Family. She's had a couple children in the interim period and working with the First Family activities. And Barbara was, I can probably summarize it by saying Barbara could do 40 hours work in 20 hours. Nancy was just willing to work all the time and just be as nice as could be, and probably in total is recognized around the White House by people who've had to deal with her. Just one of the nice people of the world and very competent. And Mary Widener has the ability to pick up and do anything. And Helen Donaldson is just a classic good judge of good ideas and doesn't miss a thing on schedule ideas. I mean, it's a real focal point. She's the one that really radiates out for us. And Mary Rollins is a walking encyclopedia of organizations and people of America in dealing with invitations, and she can respond on behalf of the President preparing letters that will go out under my signature for a while, and Terry O'Donnell and now Warren Restan, primarily the regret letters. But she also picks up the best ideas that come in, and each day forward half a dozen good ideas to us that we could consider for the President's schedule that came out of the letters. So there's a real sensitivity to that throughout the office, and because Nell Yates was also the other key bridge in all this. Nell's function, and this is a very important function, she was Chapin's secretary, and then after Chapin left, she went to work right outside the President's door, not really as Steve Bull's secretary until Beverly Kay died, but as the bridge between the schedule planning office and the schedule implementation operation. And I would submit the proposals, get the response back, either from the chief of staff or once in a while the president, and then I would dictate a memorandum to Nell Yates telling her how a particular event was to be set up and who was to be responsible for whatever. Nell would prepare all these, so she had all the information, and she wouldn't be cluttered by all the fore preparation, but exactly what was approved. And then everybody else would come back to Nell and confirm that everything could be done. And then she would work it out with Steve and Hinkle in preparation of the president's papers and things like that. So it was a pretty tight operation, but with Nell, Helen, and Mary Rollins, the three of them all worked in the appointments office over 20 years apiece. And with that continuity, they're all encyclopedias, walking encyclopedias of knowledge of people and places and events. And with those people, and then Mary Widener coming on and willing to work 12 hours a day every day, and Nancy's charm, the office just functioned very, very smoothly. I mean, well blessed, and it's difficult to lead these people at this point because that's been the real team. It's kind of like a little family that we put together, but like everything else, life must go on.
Was there a standard procedure for reviewing the effectiveness of the schedule proposals after the fact? Did you routinely review any of the meeting reports or any reports that were done on special events in which the President participated?
Well, usually it was measured by the news impact and how it was received in the press. Or many times, if it was an event that wasn't designed to have news impact, but yet was to show the President's continued leadership in the field of education and whatever, that measurement was usually done by the substantive people involved. But yet, because of the close working relationships you build up with people over the years, you get a lot of feedback like that. But did we have a specific measurement of was it a successful event versus was it not? No, our measurement, of course, was primarily news impact, and this, of course, is the reason why we read all the newspapers and news summary and watched all the network TV shows and kept a running activity in terms of how well we were doing.
I'm sure the President had expressed any particular pleasure or displeasure at the types of events. You would have received feedback from Holland.
Oh, sure. I mean, many times if the President didn't like the way something happened, we found out about it. I mean, he would tell Steve Bull or tell Haldeman or Haig or whatever, and then we would just change accordingly and continue on a new policy until he told us differently.
Did you use central files on a continuing basis?
I'm sure Helen and Nancy did a great deal. But yeah, once I put something in my drawer to run the Elk Basket, where it went to, I don't know.
Okay, well, then maybe you can't answer this question either, but I was going to ask, are there other offices where there would be a significant amount of documentation of your activities?
I wouldn't think that there are.
One would have to go to the cabinet secretary files and your files and central files. But in addition to that, do you know of any other?
No. No, Steve Bull's files. And of course, Bill Hinkle's files and Ryan Walker's files. I mean, they would all be tied in. I don't think you can really separate those files. They're all, you know, part and parcel of those activities. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the meeting briefing paper, individual files that primarily the domestic council would have. You know, Jim Cavanaugh is a great source of this stuff. Jim Cavanaugh's personal files would probably have a great deal of schedule input. In terms of any other single individual in the White House, I'm sure he would have probably has had more input outside of the schedule office and the president's schedule than anybody. Has an understanding and a real flair for it.
Are there any areas that you could single out as being areas, first of all, which would be historically significant and ones which you don't feel would be well documented that should be talked about in more depth in an oral history project? Either in a broader philosophical area or specific events even which had a particular impact.
I guess I probably don't have an understanding of what you're saying in terms of
if there is anything that stands out in your mind as something which is not going to be well documented for a Nixon library, we're just trying to pinpoint some of these areas so that we can be sure to get back to people for a Nixon oral history project. Is there anything? Often there isn't.
I can't think of anything.
Right now, it's kind of difficult when you're so close to.
No, I can't think of anything. I'll put one of those in the file.
Okay. Well, I think that's about all we.
I'm just trying to.
Cover. Or one other thing. So often there are special projects which staff are assigned. Just as a result of their being here, were there any other activities that you picked up, either short term or long term, any task forces, this kind of thing?
Not substantive things. I mean, I was involved in a lot of other things that other people were primarily responsible for, but not that I can think of offhand that I had specific responsibility in. But I mean, what I'm going to do for you here is give you have the answer make a copy of each one of these things, and you can put this in a whole in the schedule file. Included in this is a copy of the schedule that went forward for President Ford for the week of August 24, 1974, which I'm giving it to you simply to show you the form that was used in preparing weekly schedule packages. And the same system was used with President Nixon under Al Haig, where there was a specific, the date, the time assignment, and then what the event was. When Bob Haldeman was here, we attached to that specific schedule proposals. When Haig came on board, he asked not to have the specifics, but just the overview, and took it for granted that we had all the information tied down on the event itself. So I'll have Nancy give you a copy of each one of those.
Oh, one other thing. Do you have a permanent address where you might be reached?
Well, 10 years from now, I won't bet
on
that.
Or do you have a family address? Something like that is very often the best thing to.
No, I think probably my home address.
Okay.
8022 Agin, AGIN Court, McLean, Virginia, 22101.
Okay.
That's probably it.
Okay. Giving forwarding addresses to Congress.
What you ought to do, I would suggest that the Nixon Library take all the people who are on the Nixon staff, particularly the ones who are directors of offices, and every year or so, have, if it's Jack or whoever it is, maybe even under President Nixon's name, send out a letter to each one. Just a letter of a reminder, of greeting, that we went through. We served together in a very important time in America's history, regardless of the political aspect of it. And that it's the hope that, as information develops and new ideas and things that need to be contributed to the library would be forthcoming. people who subsequently write books and things like that. You'll naturally get them, but what if I write an article for the University of Michigan Political Science Review? You'd never find it, but I mean, it's that sort of thing that you could suggest to be requested. And then enclose on the bottom of a request that, you know, you're trying to keep an active index of where people can be located. And there's a self-enclosed envelope, which is your address current.
Yes, we've talked about this. I mean, it's a form of an alumni association.
Yeah,
where you want to keep in touch on what people are still doing. And we certainly do hope that there'll be an extensive oral history project, which will necessitate our keeping in touch with these people.
I hope your taping system is better than what was existed with in the Oval Office.
Do you know that this is the same model?
Was it the Sony? I thought they had some other.
The Sony 800B. We have received quite a bit of joking about that.
Well, if you will...